Okay, so start by picturing a bank vault.
You know the type, the massive, circular, heavy steel door that looks like it could survive an apocalypse? Now, imagine a piece of steel that is nearly double that thickness. We're talking solid, high-strength steel. That's what, 140 to 150 millimeters thick?
That's about 6 inches of solid metal. It's a serious slab of material.
Right.
It's the kind of thing you don't just, move around with a forklift. You build the whole factory around it.
Exactly. And in the world of nuclear power, this isn't a door, it's the reactor pressure vessel, the RPV. It's the absolute heart of the plant.
It contains everything, the fuel, the control rods, the coolant, all under just immense pressure and heat.
So the stakes for manufacturing this one thing, they couldn't be higher. If this fails, everything fails.
Absolutely. It is the single most critical safety component, the one barrier between the nuclear reaction and, well, the rest of the world. It has to be perfect.
And that is why today we are doing a deep dive into a fascinating, slightly terrifying, and incredibly nerdy piece of
I like
research.
it already.
We're asking a pretty simple but very high-stakes question. Can we stop building these massive vessels the old-fashioned way, which is slow and frankly dirty, and start zapping them together with high-powered electron beams?
It sounds like science fiction,
Yeah.
using a ray gun to build a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
But it's a very real, very serious proposal.
So we're unpacking a dissertation by Christopher J. Duffy, supervised by the legendary Professor Padeshia at Cambridge. They partnered with Rolls-Royce and the Welding Institute to see if this sci-fi welding can actually pass nuclear safety standards.
And the core of this research, the mission, if you will, it's really about validation. It's about taking a computer model, a digital twin that predicts how steel will behave, and smashing it against physical reality to see what happens.
The computer versus the atoms.
Exactly. Who wins?
Okay, so let's set the scene. The status quo. If I'm building a nuclear reactor today and I need to join two of these 6-inch thick steel rings together, how am I doing it? I'm guessing not with the glue gun.
No glue guns. The industry standard is something called submerged arc welding. And, well, it's a grind.
A grind.
Because the steel is so thick, you can't just melt it together in one shot. You have to machine this huge V-shaped groove between the plates first.
Oh.
Then you have to fill that groove pass by pass.
Like trying to fill a canyon with a shovel.
That is a perfect analogy. You lay down one bead of weld, you wait for it to cool, you chip off all the slag, this glass-like waste, and you inspect it, and then you do it all over again.
And again and again.
We're talking tens, sometimes hundreds of passes for one joint. You're constantly adding filler metal to fill the gap. It's a huge consumer of energy, consumables, and most of all, time.
How much time?
It can take weeks to weld a single seam on one of these vessels.
Weeks. Okay, that's a bottleneck. Which brings us to the challenger, electron beam welding, or RPEB. What's the sales pitch? Why are companies like Rolls-Royce so interested?
The sales pitch is speed, purity, and power. Electron beam welding, or EB, is a single-pass process.
Single pass, so one and done.
One and done. You don't need a groove. You don't need filler metal. You just line up the two square edges of the steel, and you fire a focused beam of high-velocity electrons right at the seam.
And this beam is powerful enough to go through 6 inches of steel.
It goes through like a hot knife through butter. It creates something we call a keyhole. The energy density is so incredibly high that it literally vaporizes the metal at the point of impact.
Wait, it vaporizes it, so there's a hole.
For a split second, yes, there's a column of metal vapor that drills all the way through the plate. But as the beam moves forward, the molten metal on the sides just flows around that hole and solidifies right behind it.
Wow.
It fuses the two parent plates together in one shot.
So what takes weeks with the old method?
Can be done in maybe an hour with an electron beam.
Okay.
Plus, since you're not adding filler wire, the weld's chemistry is identical to the steel itself. It's autogenous.
Autogenous, I'm adding that to my list. So it's faster, cleaner. There's got to be a catch. There's always a catch in engineering.
The catch is the atmosphere. Electrons are tiny. If you fire them through air, they just hit nitrogen and oxygen molecules and scatter everywhere. You lose all your power.
So you need a vacuum.
You need a vacuum.
Yeah.
And traditionally, that means putting the whole object inside a giant vacuum chamber.
Which is fine for, I don't know, a small gear. But for a nuclear reactor that's 10 meters across.
You can't fit that in a Tupperware container. The chamber would have to be the size of a house. Pumping all the air out would take forever. It's a logistical nightmare.
So that's where the RP and RPB comes in.
Exactly. Reduce pressure.
Yeah.
The innovation here is brilliant. Instead of putting the vessel in a vacuum, you bring the vacuum to the vessel.
How? Is it like a little suction cup?
Kind of. Imagine a robotic head that clamps onto the steel with these dynamic seals. It pumps the air out of just that tiny area where the beam is firing. It creates a local portable vacuum that just travels along the seam.
That is very, very clever. So we have the speed, we have the power. The source says they're using 150 kilovolts and over 300 milliamps.
Which is a massive linear heat input. We're talking about dumping around 45 kilowatts of power into a spot the size of a coin.
Wow. And this is where the research really kicks in, because when you dump that much heat into steel that fast and then let it cool, you are basically playing God with its atomic structure.
Precisely. And this is the danger zone. You're altering the microstructure. When steel just sits there, it's a crystal. The atoms are in a nice, neat lattice. But you melt it, and when it cools, those atoms have to rearrange themselves. The pattern they choose, the phase they become, depends almost entirely on how fast they cool.
The cooling curve.
It is the heartbeat of all metallurgy. Cool it slowly. Atoms have time to move around, find comfortable spots. Cool it fast, like quenching a sword in water, and they get trapped. They panic.
And to predict this panic, the researchers used a tool called MUG-65, which sounds like a droid from Star Wars.
Engineers aren't known for their branding, it's true. But MUG-65 is a powerful digital twin tool. It uses thermodynamics, what the steel wants to become, and kinetic theory, how fast it can become that.
So it's a weather forecast for metal. It looks at the chemistry and the cooling speed and says, tomorrow, there's a 60% chance of bainite and a 20% chance of martensite.
That's a great analogy. But for that forecast to be right, you need good data going in. So the researchers had to measure the real cooling rate first. They embedded thermocouples at like 6 millimeter, 8 millimeter, 10 millimeters away from the weld.
To see exactly how fast that heat was escaping into the cold metal.
Right. They fit a mathematical curve to those readings to get these coefficients, C to 1M and C to 1N2 towns. Those numbers represent the thermal reality. Then they fed those into MUG-65.
Okay, let's talk about what the simulation is actually looking for. You mentioned bainite and martensite. This sounds like a cast of characters. I'm thinking of it as the Game of Thrones of steel phases.
It's a battle for dominance, for sure. And the winner determines if your reactor is safe or a ticking time bomb.
So set the stage. The metal is liquid hot. As it starts to cool, it solidifies into a phase called austenite.
Austenite is the parent, the high temperature phase. The iron atoms are arranged in a face-centered cubic lattice. It's a very open structure, stable when hot. But as the temperature drops, austenite gets unstable. It desperately wants to transform into a lower energy structure called ferrite.
But there are different types of ferrite, right? Depending on how much time the atoms have.
Exactly. It's a race. The first contender is allotriomorphic ferrite. This is the polite phase. It forms when cooling is slow. The atoms have time and energy to diffuse, to wiggle into the perfect spot. It's soft and ductile.
But we're electron beam welding. We're cooling fast, so the polite stuff probably doesn't have a chance.
Not much of one.
Yeah.
The atoms don't have time to diffuse. So you start getting Widmanstetten ferrite, which grows in these aggressive-looking plates. And if you go even faster, you get bainite.
Bainite. The source calls this sheaf-like aggregates.
Bainite is a hybrid. It's part diffusion, part shear. Meaning the crystal lattice itself physically snaps and shifts, forms at lower temperatures, and it's generally a really good structure to have. It's strong and tough. In this story, bainite is usually the hero.
But then there's the one we're afraid of, the thug of the group.
Martensite.
Martensite even sounds like a villain.
In this context, it is. Martensite forms when the cooling is just violent, so fast that the carbon atoms trapped inside the austenite don't have time to get out. They get stuck.
They're trapped in the crystal structure.
Worse, they're trapped in a cage that's shrinking as it cools. They distort the lattice so much that the whole structure just snaps into a new, highly strained shape.
Yeah.
It's like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole by just smashing it with a hammer. This makes the metal incredibly hard.
But hard is good, right? We want hard things.
You want a knife edge to be hard. You do not want a pressure vessel to be hard. In metallurgy, hardness almost always means brittleness. You want a reactor to be tough. It can absorb energy, it dents. Martensite is like glass. You hit it, it shatters.
And a shattering nuclear reactor is bad.
The absolute worst case scenario. So the whole point of the simulation is to predict. Are we getting the friendly bainite or the brittle martensite thug?
Got it. Now, the researchers didn't just test one steel. They compared the old standard against a new contender.
Right. They looked at SA508 grade 3. The workhorse steel, and they compared it to SA508 grade 4N.
So what's the difference? What's the N for?
Nickel. Grade 3 has a little bit, maybe 0.7%. Grade 4N jacks that up to around 3.7%.
That doesn't sound like a huge change, just 3%?
In the world of alloys, 3% is massive. It completely changes the personality of the steel. Nickel is what we call an austenite stabilizer.
Okay, break that down for me.
Remember austenite, the hot parent phase? Nickel basically makes it more comfortable at lower temperatures. It delays the transformation. It tells the austenite, hey, don't change yet. Stay as you are. It's not cold enough.
So nickel is like that friend who convinces you to stay at the party way too long.
That is actually a perfect way to put it. But eventually, the party has to end. And because the transformation is delayed to a much lower temperature, when it finally happens, the atoms are cold. They're sluggish.
So they can't diffuse as easily.
Exactly. Atoms move much slower in the cold. So adding all that nickel suppresses the polite phases. It forces the metal to wait and wait until it's so cold that the only option left is the snap. The shear transformation.
Which gives you bainite or martensite.
Precisely. Grade 4N is chemically programmed to skip the soft stuff and go straight for the hard stuff.
So what did the MUG 65 model predict would happen?
For the standard grade 3 steel, it predicted a pretty safe mix. Mostly bainite, about 66%, with some martensite, maybe 20%. Manageable.
And for the high nickel grade 4N?
The model saw the nickel. It predicted the martensite content would jump to 41%.
Yeah.
It was a warning sign. Hey, this new steel is going to be a lot harder.
41% is high. But this is where the story takes a turn, because they didn't just trust the computer. They actually did the welds and cut them open.
The reality check. They looked under the microscope and used Vickers hardness testing.
Okay, let's start with grade 3. Did the model get it right?
It did pretty well. The hardness was around 290 HV.
HV is Vickers hardness.
Yes. 290 HV is firm, but totally reasonable for a weld. Visually, they saw a mix that looked like bainite and martensite, so the model was in the ballpark. A useful prediction.
Okay, so far so good for MUG 65. But then they looked at the new grade 4N. The computer said 41% martensite. What did they actually find?
They found a brick wall. The hardness of the grade 4N weld. The numbers went off the charts. They measured values up to 500 HV, even 533 HV in one spot.
Whoa. From 290 for the standard to over 500.
That is a massive jump. In the world of steel, 500 HV is incredibly hard. And that hardness is a proxy for extreme brittleness.
So the computer said 41% martensite, but a hardness of 500 HV suggests...
What?
It suggests the structure is almost entirely martensite. The thug didn't just show up to the party, he took over the whole neighborhood. The model significantly underestimated just how much that nickel would change the game. Why did the model fail so badly? Was the code wrong?
Not necessarily the code, but maybe the inputs? Remember those cooling coefficients? The researchers suspect the model underestimated just how fast the heat was being pulled out at those lower temperatures, right where the transformation happens.
So the digital twin said caution, but reality was screaming stop.
Exactly. And this has a huge practical implication. If you're a manufacturer and you just made a weld that's sitting there at 500 HVC, you have a ticking time bomb on your factory floor.
Because of cracking.
Yes. A phenomenon called cold cracking. When you have a microstructure, this brittle, pure martensite, and it's full of internal stress just from cooling down, it's extremely susceptible to cracking.
And this can happen just while it's sitting there.
It can happen hours later while it's just cooling to room temperature. You could walk away for a coffee, come back, and find a crack running right through your multi-million dollar component.
That is terrifying. But there's a fix for this, right? They don't leave the weld like that. You do something called PWHT.
Post-weld heat treatment. Yes, it's mandatory.
It sounds like a spa treatment for the reactor.
It basically is. Yeah. You put the whole massive component into a giant furnace. You bake it at around 600 degrees Celsius for anywhere from 3 to 30 hours.
And what does baking it do?
It tempers the martensite. The heat gives those trapped carbon atoms just enough energy to wiggle out of their cage and form tiny, harmless carbides. It relaxes the crystal structure, relieves the stress, the hardness drops, and toughness returns.
And it worked for the grade 4N.
It did. After heat treatment, that scary 500 HV dropped all the way down to a totally manageable 310, 320 HV.
So problem solved.
Yes and no. The final product is safe. The danger is the gap. The window of time between finishing the weld and getting that massive 100-ton part into the furnace.
And during that window, if the weld is at 500 HV...
It is vulnerable. It could crack while you're moving it. It could crack just sitting there. And if it cracks, the heat treatment won't fix it. You can't bake out a crack. The part is ruined.
So it adds this huge layer of risk that the simulation didn't fully capture.
Exactly. If you just trusted the model, you might have thought, 41% martensite, we've got time. But reality showed you had zero margin for error.
The researchers also mentioned it was hard to visually tell what was what.
Right.
Right. Distinguishing between, say, bainite and another phase called acicular ferrite with a standard optical microscope is notoriously difficult. They look very similar, just like a messy pile of straw.
They needed the CSI microscope.
They needed a transmission electron microscope, really. They admit they're relying heavily on the hardness numbers to figure out what's there. But when the hardness is 500 HV, there's very little doubt what the dominant phase is.
So let's bring it all back. We started by asking if we can modernize nuclear construction. What's the verdict from this deep dive?
The verdict is yes, but watch your step. Electron beam welding works. It's viable. And post-weld heat treatment makes the final product safe. It was probably the future of the industry.
Bruh.
But the interaction between this advanced welding and these newer high-nickel steels is spikier than we thought. The window for error is much smaller.
And the computer models we use to predict that error, they aren't perfect.
They're indicators, not guarantees. This is a classic reminder that in engineering, the map is not the territory. You can have the best software in the world, but until you physically melt the metal and poke it with a diamond, you don't know for sure.
It's almost humbling. We're building these massive things, but success comes down to how a few microscopic carbon atoms decide to dance as they cool down.
That's the beauty and the terror of metallurgy. A 3% change in nickel changes the entire dance, and suddenly your whole manufacturing plan has to change to avoid catastrophe.
I saw a phrase in the notes, missing the bainite nose. Can you explain that? It sounds hilarious.
It does sound funny. It refers to a type of diagram that shows how phases form over time. On this graph, the region where bainite forms looks like a nose jutting out.
A nose, okay.
If your cooling is fast enough, your cooling line on the graph goes right past the nose without ever touching it. You miss the nose.
Mm-hmm.
And if you miss the bainite nose, you fall straight down into the martensite region.
I love that. So the high nickel grade 4N steel effectively pushed the nose out of the way, guaranteeing you'd fall into the martensite trap.
That is a very colorful but physically accurate way to describe it.
So for the listener, whether you're an engineer or just someone who likes knowing their local power plant isn't going to crack, what's the big takeaway?
The takeaway is that this manufacturing revolution with electron beam welding is coming. The speed is too good to ignore. But as we move to these better, stronger materials, we have to rigorously, physically validate our digital twins. We can't just simulate safety into existence.
And maybe we need to respect the thug phase of steel a little bit more.
Always respect the martensite. It doesn't negotiate.
That feels like a solid life lesson. Thanks for walking us through the lattice today. That was heavy stuff, but really fascinating.
My pleasure.
And to you listening, thanks for diving deep with us. If you want to see the graphs where that hardness number for grade 4N just goes vertical, check out the show notes. It's a stark reminder that in physics, nature always gets the last word. Until next time.